Sky News Centre at 5. One man has been killed and two others injured after a shooting at a boxing match weigh-in in Dublin. Unconfirmed reports say an AK-47 style rifle may have been used and that the attackers were dressed in uniform when they burst into the Regency Hotel at around 2:30 this afternoon. Our reporter Enda Brady has a statement from police.
They say emergency services responding to reports of a shooting discovered three men, all in their 20s or 30s, injured at the scene. One of these men was subsequently pronounced dead. The scene is sealed off and a technical examination of the area is expected to take place.
Julian Assange has addressed supporters from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London after a UN report says he's being arbitrarily detained in the UK.
How sweet it is. This is a victory that cannot be denied. It is a victory of historical importance.
The WikiLeaks founder has lived in that building for over 3 years. He went there to avoid being arrested and extradited to Sweden to be questioned about a rape allegation, which he denies. The Foreign Secretary has called the report ridiculous and says the UK rejects it. The family of PC David Rathband, who was shot and blinded by Raoul Moat in 2010, has lost a High Court negligence claim against Northumbria Police. His relatives say he should have been warned about Moat's threats to harm officers. Two more people have been jailed in connection with the murder of Becky Watts. Carl Demetrius and Jadeen Parsons helped her killer hide the 16-year-old's body in a shed at their home in Bristol. A planned 48-hour strike this weekend by London Underground workers has been called off. Members of the RMT union were due to walk out at 9 p.m. on Saturday, which would have disrupted tube services into next week. And tributes are being paid to Maurice White, the founder of Earth, Wind and Fire, who's died in L.A. at the age of 74. His brother and fellow band member Verdeen has described him as his hero and best friend. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
It's Friday's 5 o'clock. Yes, welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. Tony Gosling. And helping me review this week's news is independent candidate for Bristol Mayor Jane Westhead. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. A supposedly discovery of Roman artefacts in Newfoundland over Christmas has reawakened questions over Bristol's role in the discovery of America. We talk about that after the 6 o'clock news. Did the Romans and the Vikings get there first? Did English fishermen know all about the nearby Grand Banks but kept it quiet? Were there European encampments in Virginia and elsewhere before the Matthew and John Cabot began the process of mapping the coastline in 1497? We're joined by the man who hopefully can answer some of these questions. Dr. Evan Jones joins us from the Bristol University's Cabot Project. Also, US intelligence officers kidnapping Muslims in Italy, then fleeing to Portugal. But the Italian justice system is catching up on them. And the Pentagon quadruple their European defence spending on the same week as the BBC transmit a war game programme about the Russian tanks invading the Baltic states. Is this what they call predictive programming? Politicians and public being prepared for a real Russian attack or a fake one? We explore predictive programming, eerie broadcasts which air before major events like the 7/7 London bombings, and we ask, is this now a tool of psychological warfare with the security services and NATO effectively producing primetime TV? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, very wet and windy. And windy conditions with a risk of flooding in places this weekend. Next week, highs again 10 Celsius, wet and windy conditions easing off as the week progresses, leaving sunny but cooler weather at the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of February, highs again around 10 Celsius, sunshine and showers, strong winds. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So anyway, helping us review this week's news is independent candidate for Bristol Mayor, Jane Westhead. Hi, Jane. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Jane. Why have you put yourself forward for mayor, and what's your background?
I haven't actually put myself forward for mayor.
Aren't you?
No. We're going to promote Christine Townsend.
Okay, so your Independence for Bristol. Tell us a bit about about Independence for Bristol.
Independence of Bristol was set up a few years ago following George Ferguson's, just following the election campaign, the last mayoral campaign. And we are a bunch of individuals who want to promote ordinary people in the communities going into politics and standing for election. A lot of the people who were involved in it did come from the background of supporting George Ferguson's campaign. But there are a number of people who are still in it who want to promote ordinary people in the communities.
Okay, so George would say he's an independent for Bristol, so why aren't you supporting him?
Because I think it's important to show that anyone can stand for election, and I think anyone should. And I was really inspired by the hustings at the Trinity Centre last time, all the different candidates getting up and giving their views. And I was very aware of what a macho show it was. And there was only one woman on the panel, which was Daniella. And
that's from the Greens.
She really did not come across very well. Not because she wasn't a good candidate, but that sort of forum didn't allow her to, you know, to shine. And it was very aggressive. So I felt, but it was very exciting that, you know, lots of ordinary people had just put themselves forward. And I thought, I was really interested in, you know, a lot of these independent candidates.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the Lib Dem party put forward Barbara Jank, didn't they, to be the leader, and she was the leader. And so why don't you just join them if surely there is an existing in politics now, same of course with the leader of the Labour group, Helen Holland. There's an acknowledgement that there must be proper equality, and women should be able to represent people just as well as men, and they can and they do.
But I still think that you are subject to a party structure. And actually, I went to a meeting recently with Daniella and Helen Holland, which was about promoting women into politics. But it was basically like, join the Green Party or the Labour Party. And if you don't want to be in a party because you're not always happy with all the structures, you know, I think it is important to have people who genuinely want to represent some of the communities that they are in.
Do you think women make better politicians?
Yes, I do, actually. I'm really, really pleased that we've got all women MPs in Bristol.
Isn't that just sexist?
I think...
All right, why? Maybe that's a better question. Why do women make better
politicians? Well, they're less aggressive. It's certainly in the hustings environment. And I think they engage with communities better. They've got more sort of soft skills, which I think are actually really important in politics. And I think they're more likely to be more caring. Yes, that is sexist. I do acknowledge that quite sexist.
Don't politicians have to fight for the public? Don't they have to be...
They have to be advocates, yes, but they shouldn't be aggressive. And I think the sort of tribalism that goes on in politics, I think if we had more women, there would be less of that. I think that there would be more cooperation. That's my personal view, and I could be wrong, but obviously... I would like to see... I can't compare it to anything because we've got so few women politicians. So
Margaret Thatcher is one that springs to mind as soon as anyone says, oh, women.
Well, I know. It's very sad that that's the only example that we've got, but she did have a lot of good points as well as quite obvious flaws.
Well, as council leader, Barbara Jank has done quite a good job, hasn't she, up in the House of Lords in making sure that we're going to have another referendum now on whether we want a mayor. So there has been a bit. But I mean, don't you feel that without a party to back you up, you're missing the sort of force multiplication that comes with a whole load of brains working on the same topic and the knowledge sharing that comes from that?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think this is one of the things that we found from Independence for Bristol, is that when you haven't got the backing of a party, it's the whole thing is quite a struggle, because you haven't got the backup of, well, not that the main parties have got loads of volunteers, to be fair, but you certainly haven't got the funding available. And once you actually get into the council, then you find that you haven't necessarily got the support. So there are definitely disadvantages, but I think it's important to get more people involved in the democratic process. I actually don't see that it's all about winning. I think standing for election itself is very, very important.
Whoever wins, though, gets to be dictator in the way we've got things at the moment. I mean, it's a little bit scary, isn't it? You're like, you know, you can either be benevolent or you could be like the Sheriff of Nottingham sitting up there at City Hall. Tell us a bit about you. What's your background? Where have you come to this from? What's your professionally?
I just saw an email from Stacey Yelland, actually, in her bulletin, saying we look at this organisation, Independence for Bristol, and they're wanting to...
Sorry, who's Stacey? She's from Independence
for Bristol. She's from Upper Street, which is a local charity.
Oh, okay.
And it was inviting just ordinary people to go and stand for election. So I went to an interview and a panel of quite a lot of people, actually, about 14 people, and they interviewed me for an hour about why I wanted to stand for election, and that was it. You know, I was just hooked.
What about your day job, though? What's your...
I work in the NHS at the moment as a medical secretary.
And what does that mean?
That means that I type up the consultants' letters, file the notes, occasionally deal with patient queries.
Well, because this is a bit of a political hot potato at the moment, the NHS, isn't it? And it has been for probably since 2010, the Health and Social Care Act.
Before that I was a care worker, actually, for a year and a half.
What can you tell us about the changes you've seen going on in the NHS?
Well, I've been in the NHS a year, so it's difficult to say, really, about the actual changes in the NHS. I do quite a specific job, and it's not... I don't necessarily see the bigger picture all the time, but certainly when I did the care work job, I was really made aware of the disconnect between, the NHS, the hospital services, and the privatisation of care. There's just completely low margins, run on absolute shoestring, and people are just not getting the care that they need. It's a mess, a total mess.
Well, one of the things they said over the last couple of days is that 1 out of 10 hospital beds, in some cases more than that, people actually in hospital don't need to be there. It's just that there is not the arrangements now, proper arrangements for respite care and care outside the hospital for people to go to. It just seems like the system seems to be breaking down almost.
It really is bad out in the that world. And it used to be we had all these services provided by the council, and people, the staff were paid properly and they had good conditions. Now, I mean, I've never ever worked in a job that has had such horrific conditions, and I have actually had a lot of jobs, but I've never known a job. The rotors would change. At one point, they changed 9 times in one day. So you could start off in Frenchay, then you're going off to Stockwood, then you go back to Brislington. And, it's just... you're all over Bristol. It's very, very chaotic. And people are constantly... it's a 0 hours contract. People are constantly going off sick.
Okay, so I suppose a $64,000 question has got to be, what is Independence for Bristol? What is the vision for the city?
What is the vision for the city? Well, I think it's about just getting ordinary people to engage in politics. I mean, because it is not a party, well, it is a party in name. People always say, but you are a party. But it's like, well, we've got to be, because otherwise it's ridiculously complicated.
So you don't really have policies you don't have policies like ordinary parties
do. We just don't. We don't have policies.
Every time a question comes along, you think, I know, let's just do what's best.
Yeah. With, look at it on that level, and that's why it is quite difficult for people to buy into. But I think part of my personal vision for it is to get people engaged with politics. I mean, if somebody is talking about politics to me, I'll definitely forward them, signpost them to a political party if that's what they want. But obviously, I'll try and encourage them to become independent. But, you know, I'll put them forward across to, the Labour Party or the Greens, whoever they want to join. I say, you know, if you want to get involved in it, do. And I know about the opportunities available. So for me, it's about getting people engaged in the political process. And I would like to encourage people that feel that they're just totally disconnected from politics. You know, there's a lot of those people who just feel it's not for them. And I say, well, if you don't like it, I mean, you know, I have conversations with people all the time about politics, and people say, I can't stand George Ferguson, or, you know, the Labour Party this or whatever. And I say, well, why don't you get involved? You know, and they say, oh, no, I would never do that. And I say, well, you know, put your money where your mouth is.
Exactly, yeah. well, we've been this afternoon. There's been quite a sizeable protest down at Colston Hall for the closing ceremony for Bristol Green Capital 2015. And actually, a large part of politics and about what a mayor will be doing and is doing is about spending our money. We're basically deciding, right, this is a priority, this isn't a priority. Obviously, they're not making legislation apart from things like bylaws to evict people camping out, homeless people in parks in the city centre, in the city local authority here. But a lot of it is around is how they spend our money. And I wonder what you make of this today. £8.3 million pounds of Green Capital money, and the former MP Stephen Williams is making it absolutely clear. He's saying we want some transparency over how this has been spent, because certainly I remember reading when it all started, this the Bristol Green Capital thing, beginning of last year, the Bristol Cable newspaper did a brilliant piece showing that actually there were some quite interesting personal connections through George Ferguson's family and also through the merchant venturers. And of course, George, although he said I'm not a merchant venturer anymore when he became mayor, appointed a fellow merchant venturer as the chairman of Bristol Green Capital. And now, because that's a private company, they're only doing kind of headline accounts. So I wonder what you make of all that, because it seems as if the scrutiny, any kind of understanding of where our money's going, this is 8.3 million here, is kind of disappearing over the horizon. It's almost like a mirage. We can't quite see how it's being spent anymore.
Yeah. Well, I just love this story when I saw it in the paper this week. And I thought, Stephen Williams, I saw him every night on the Bristol West hustings. And I thought, he's learning from our Christine Townsend, because she puts in a lot of freedom of information requests. But yeah, I think I agree with him. He has to be acknowledged, actually, for getting that money to us in the first place. He had a big hand in that. And, you know, I agree with the lack of transparency, maybe from a formal point of view it was done, but people do, the ordinary person on the street would say, I don't know what happened to that money and all these art projects that people couldn't really understand. I know that they said that the Arts Council actually paid for the arts projects, but it is a tremendous amount of money, and it's difficult to see where it did go.
I mean, the Green Party and Independence for Bristol, probably not Independence, but certainly the Green Party and the Labour Party, I'll bring Martin Summers in here, were notable by their absence down there today, almost as if to say, well, the Labour Party are quite happy about how this money was spent, and they don't want to do any kind of joint campaign to find out what happened to all this money with the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems are doing this pretty much single-handed.
Well, I have to admit that I have no idea how the money's been spent.
Well, that's the whole point.
And I think Stephen Williams may have a fair point here. If we don't know how it's been spent, then we ought to know. So he may well be in the right here.
Well, I'll tell you what.
I have no knowledge myself.
Let's hear it from the horse's mouth, because I spoke to Stephen Williams earlier on today outside Colston Hall about this whole what happened to the 8 million Green Capital money.
I'm Stephen Williams. I'm the former MP for Bristol West. I'm here. Unfortunately, outside the closing event for European Green Capital. I would rather have been inside celebrating some of the things that have been done during the year. But the reason I'm not is I'm furious with the council and the mayor for not telling us how they've spent £8 million worth of taxpayers' money. This is an age of sustainability, but it's also an age of transparency. And people have an absolute right to know how their money's been spent by the people they elect to spend it. And the council's refusal to disclose, other than the most broadest of sort of brackets of how they spent £8 million, is really not acceptable. Before I was an MP, I worked for 17 years in the corporate sector, so I'm fully aware of the sort of information that companies have to provide to their shareholders. And in this sense, the shareholders are all of us as citizens, as taxpayers, and the council has been running these events on our behalf. And it's a great shame that the council won't tell us how much has been spent on hotels, how much has been spent on conferences, how much has been awarded in contracts to people. And I actually believe it's not really in their interest to do this, because that obviously is going to arouse suspicion that the money's not been well used.
The similar things were going on, weren't they, under the Lib Dems?
I would think if every time we got money when we were running the council for something, such as building new schools or things like that, people could see where the money was being spent. You know, as an MP for 10 years for the city, I helped bring in a lot of government money into the city, in particular the 5 years when I was part of the government governing party of the country from 2010 onwards. But you can see those schools, you can see those youth centres, you know about the rail investment that's coming and so on. The £8 million that's been allocated to European Green Capital, it's actually quite hard for me or anyone else I've talked to point to something tangible and enduring that has been used, that has been put in place as a result of receiving that money.
So are you suggesting that this is favours for friends, some of this money?
Well, it could be. Certainly other people have suggested that, but because they won't tell us what is the value of the contracts that have been given to certain people and what were they for, we can't be sure.
I mean, just to themselves say commercial confidentiality, we can't tell you. Some of these are private businesses.
That is complete nonsense if they come up with that excuse. First of all, local government has a statutory duty to be transparent about the spending of its money. In fact, the transparency level is actually quite low. It's £500 for ordinary expenditure, and for the value of a contract, it's £5,000. Anything above £5,000, local government has to disclose the full details of the contract. That's because, for fair competition, people have to be able to say, well, I could have done that for less.
So are you hopeful that this will be disclosed before the mayoral elections in May?
Well, experience so far doesn't lend much hope to this, I'm afraid. That's why I've got involved, because lots of other people have been trying to get the information. Councillors by asking questions in the council itself, members of the public by tabling freedom of information requests, and all of them have been stonewalled, saying that this is not subject to freedom of information because the money may have been spent via a company. But the truth is that company, Bristol 2015 Limited, was set up by the council. The directors were appointed by the council. So it's unforgivable to hide behind that corporate veil.
Former MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams, there speaking to me earlier today about the missing £8.3 million, as the Ian Onions in the Bristol Post reported it. Martin, the question here really is about confidentiality. What's happened is a certain amount of money, the very top line figures have been disclosed, but the rest hasn't. And they're saying, well, we want to know, where did it all go?
Well, I think it's a well-made point that if you set up a company to carry out the project, that company is not... what they seem to be arguing is that because it's an independent company, they don't have to account for the money because it's been transferred from the council. Now, that's pretty disingenuous, isn't it? I mean, you could argue that the council should have spent the money in-house, in which case they would have had to account for it. And this is what's worrying about this quangocracy that we live in, where that we set up independent, supposedly independent organisations, third sector organisations, which have all these touchy-feely mission statements, but they're not accountable. It's like the housing associations are not accountable in the same way that councils were when they ran council housing. And as a socialist, I believe in democratic accountability. And a lot of this touchy-feely third sector stuff does lead to the suspicion that a lot of the money has basically been spent on junkets for, you know, the green elite of the city to jet around the place and pontificate about sustainability.
Well, talking about the elite of the city, merchant venturer Andrew Garrard was appointed by George Ferguson to chair Bristol 2015 Limited, and he didn't really want to stop when I was down there, but I managed to sort of run along next to him and ask him a couple of questions, and he had a PR guy stood next to him who said to me, no, he doesn't want to answer any questions, but then of course when I did ask him the question, he was happy to, even though he was only for a few seconds. So let's have a little listen to that encounter now. So this is me speaking earlier on today to Andrew Garrard, who was the chair of Bristol 2015 Limited.
I'm the chair of Bristol 2015.
And are you looking forward to a good little successful meeting in here?
I think it should be very successful, yes. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Are you happy about the disclosure of the figures?
Yeah, we've produced accounts to the audit committee on four occasions, next time going next month. We produced accounts for DEC, we produced accounts for the City Council, we produced accounts for the European Commission. I think we've done a pretty thorough job. Thanks very much.
What's your name?
What's his name?
Don't have a name.
Gary. He doesn't have a name.
He does have a name.
What is it?
He told you his name a minute ago.
Well, that was the PR guy saying he told you his name a minute ago, which he quite self-evidently didn't, but that's PR people for you. Martin, this is actually a bit disappointed to see that there's only one political party in the city. In fact, there was one of the mayor candidates, Paul Saville, was down there too, that people aren't making more of a fuss about the real fragments only of information that have been given out about this. I think for a lot of people, they look at Bristol Green Capital as a kind of load of greenwash, really, where there's nothing much to show for it at the end of the day.
Well, that obviously has to be the suspicion. I mean, there's a lot of green sentiment in Bristol, but of course the traffic in Bristol is still the worst, some of the worst in the country.
In Europe, actually.
So an awful lot of what goes on in Bristol is people aspire to green values, and I would include George Ferguson in this, and the Green Party, and the Labour Party, and the Lib Dems. Even the Tories have got a green tinge in Bristol, but there's an element of cynicism, I have to say, in the poorer parts of the city about all of this. When you knock on doors, they tend to regard it as a bit of a self-regarding, smug little club for those who are involved.
Well, I also spoke to Christian Martin, who's a former councillor in Clifton for the Lib Dems.
Christian Martin, former Liberal Democrat councillor for Clifton East. I'm here protesting at the secrecy, the veil of secrecy that George has thrown over the Green Capital accounts. You know, the best analogy I've given someone today is when you go shopping, you don't get a till receipt that just simply says shopping on it. You have a breakdown of what was in your basket and what you bought. We want to know what was in the Green Capital basket and what we bought with the money.
Why are you so suspicious about it? Surely, I mean, it's been quite a success, Green Capital, and certainly there is, some would say, well, they've given you certain accounts, and why should you need more? Aren't you just sour grapes, maybe, that the mayor's made such a success of this?
No. The mayor inherited Green Capital from previous administrations that had bid and successfully won. The year was a great success, there's no doubt about that, but the actual minutiae, the detail that's always the devil in the detail, that we want to have a look at to see whether or not any money was wasted, is hidden behind the headline figures that have been published. This idea that he has allowed councillors and the public to scrutinise is absolutely incorrect. Giving people headline global totals is not the same as giving us the detail. And if we got the detail, we could ask the questions, was it spent wisely? Where's the legacy projects? Where's the lasting tangible benefit for the city?
So how much are we talking about? Because actually most of this money was a sort of parachuted in. It wasn't didn't come out of council taxpayers' money.
£7 million from the government that Stephen Williams at the time lobbied government to get for us, and he got that through DEC. So it's £7 million, of which we know £2 million went into the local grants, and we can see those because they've all been published, but what happened to the rest of it?
How was it spent, and what's wrong with the way that it was spent?
Well, let's look at the idiosyncratic example, which is the nutless tree, the recording of nuts dropping from a tree that didn't bear any fruit. I mean, £37,500, £76,000 on a solar hot air balloon that we don't even own, and we don't even know what the practical application of that is for a green city. £200,000 on a website. A website that just contained information but wasn't an interactive data gathering website that enabled you to download apps or anything like that to encourage you to engage in the Green Capital Year. £200,000. £272,000 on volunteers. If they're volunteers, what are you paying for? We need the detail. How many people got paid salaries? What were the salaries that people got paid? How many hotels were bought and rooms purchased out of the £1.6 million that were spent on summits for international delegates? I mean, the list is endless. We haven't got that detail.
Is there any implication that there's any been any favours for friends and family by the mayor?
I can't comment on that. I don't know. And again, maybe, and certainly this is what's courting all the suspicion, we don't know whether that's the case because we haven't been able to see the accounts. If we were open to seeing the accounts, or the accounts were rather opened up to us to have a look at, there might be some correlative links. You don't know, but I don't want to cast aspersions. But certainly
on his daughter, for example, who certainly the Bristol Cable reported was a beneficiary of some of these funds.
Yeah, the Bristol Cable did an incredibly great investigation into and thorough investigation into all of the correlative links, and I think people should go and have a look at that. I don't want to cast any aspersions, although you know I won't to, but what I would say is the longer the silence goes on and the longer there are protestations from the mayor that we are naysayers and troublemakers, the more he courts suspicion on why he will not open up the books.
Well, one of the projects that got Bristol its green capital status in the run-up to 2015 was the hydrogen-powered boats from the harbour, which I hadn't come across before. But one of the people who was there just to witness this whole spectacle today of the ending of green capital and big rounds of applause. Actually, as I was speaking to him, I noticed a whole load of Bristol City Council security guards rushing in. So I'm not quite sure what was going on. You know, I have to watch Points West to find out what was going on in the actual ceremony itself. As he explained, he'd been working on these hydrogen-powered boats, which helped Bristol actually win the award in the first place.
My name is Alejandro. I work for the number 7 boat trips, like boat trip company in the harbour. Basically, I'm here because before the European Green Capital, the council spent hundreds of thousands of pounds building Britain's first hydrogen boat. It was a successful project. When George came into power, cancelled the project and cancelled all the funding to it. He was shot. That was one of the things that got Bristol the European Green Capital. And as soon as they got the money, they cancelled the project.
They're thinking about things like libraries, aren't they? You've got to prioritise.
Well, yeah, but this is one of the things they actually give Bristol the award. They cancelled that. They stopped the boat to collect the rubbish in the harbour. They just cut the budget for that. It only runs once a week now. The harbour is really dirty now. They just flush everything into the Avon Court. And, I mean, it's supposed to be the green capital. So where's the money went? On a fog bridge? On some shipwrecks in Leewoods? So basically, yeah, I'm just here to see what's going on with that. What happened with all the money? One of the projects was an art installation. They brought a Japanese artist to install something on Perros Bridge. And the idea was, like, looks like it's foggy all the time. That cost £100,000, and that was it. It was just foggy all the time for about 3 weeks. They came and asked us if we support the project, and we thought, like, that would be bad for navigation.
Yes, bad for navigation to have fog all the time, I suppose, if you're going around the floating harbour. But, Jane, there's a serious side to this. £100,000 of public money being spent on a fog bridge, which is there for 3 days. You're also talking about, you know, other vast projects, which are very ephemeral. It's all now gone.
Yeah, I was reading that I'm not sure that was all funded, that all the arts projects were funded by the Green Capital money, because I was reading that some of it was funded by the Arts Council.
See, it might be.
Might be wrong.
It may be.
That's why we need Christian Martin's shopping list. We need that.
Okay, moving on. Bristol region could have a metro mayor within the next few years. The area is likely to have a metro mayor, a post which would unlock billions of pounds for new investment in the region. Right, so if you want your money, you've got to have your metro mayor, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think the problem with this is that, you know, the northern powerhouse idea on Merseyside up in Newcastle is that politically Merseyside is pretty much solidly Labour. So there's no problem with, say, Manchester City Council, Liverpool City Council working with local authorities outside the metropolitan area. But Bristol has actually got a political culture rather different from the political culture in Bath or Somerset or Wiltshire. And the Tories that tend to run the rural parts of the counties are very, very unhappy about the idea of some radical philanthropist like George Ferguson or some lefty politician like Marvin Rees telling them what to do in Western Supermare. And I think that they will sabotage it. They're just not interested. They never have been.
There's another side to this, Jane, isn't there? And that is that if you're making a metro mayor for a much bigger region, it's actually not going to be a concentrated urban thing. It's going to be much more rural. South Gloucestershire, Bath, North Somerset, those sorts of places are much more Tory. So you get almost certainly you're going to move over to the right. So this is going to change the political makeup of the mayor.
I think it's a great idea, but I see what you're saying, Martin, about the demographic is quite different than those northern powerhouses. I mean, in Manchester, it works brilliantly well.
Is there any such thing as this northern powerhouse? Well, I was watching BBC Question Time, and some very canny lad from Sheffield said, "Look, it's just a load of nonsense. There's no such thing. They just say whatever it is they're going to do to get elected,
well,
and then they do something different."
I suppose it's the fact that it's integrated. You know, there's lots of connections. There's certainly on a transport point of view, I think it would be really, really
but
good.
Can you have a retail-based powerhouse? That what they're saying is there's no industry. It's just a retail, a new shopping centre or something. Is that a powerhouse?
Well, I mean, this term power, look, could you put that on one side? I mean, that's proper.
Yeah. How about put it in the bin?
Yeah, let's,
I think
we'll bin
there are two problems in Bristol. You're either going to get the kind of mayor that Bristol is going to elect in May, which will be, you know, a progressive, no doubt about it. If Ferguson wins, he's a progressive. If Marvin wins, he's a progressive. If the Greens win, they're progressives. But the politics of the surrounding areas are less so. Now, you could either end up with a situation where Bristol has its progressive mayor because of the numbers of people in Bristol, and then they'll be telling Western Supermare Tories what to do, or the thing that makes me shudder in my bed is we'll end up with some Western Supermare Tory running Bristol, in fact, when they've got no real support on the ground inside the city.
Well, there's the other side of this, which is that we may be on the verge of having a referendum to say, no, we don't want even a mayor for the city. So is there any mandate for a metro mayor? It just seems to me like somebody's sitting down, right, we're going to have a metro mayor for Bristol, and no one is actually being asked about this. Is it? Anyway, next story, a deaf campaign for a new Bristol social club. This is on the BBC this week. Former deaf Centre for Deaf Building in Kingsbridge is now a conference and office facility. Deaf people who are upset because they had to sell their social club building and have started to campaign for a new one. Trustee Sandra Smith said the deaf club closure was like losing my family. She said, we do need a new base where people know they can come and meet, especially for young people. Well, I wonder what you make of this, Jane.
Yeah, I saw this on Points West, actually, and my initial reaction was, obviously, that is very sad, but why, how did it get to that situation? It sounds quite an extreme thing to happen, and I don't know all the backstory about the trustees.
Apparently it was a pension fund had a deficit, and so they had to sell the building to pay off the pension fund deficit.
But you would think that would have been, you know, taken into account in advance by the management and the trustees. Obviously, it's a charity, so, you know, there's a governance.
So who's
system.
Running that particular pension fund? We don't know, do we? But anyway, Martin, it's at the end of the day, this is a real blow for deaf people in the city, knowing what it's been going since 1962 off King Square, this place, and there's nowhere for deaf people to go now.
Well, it's sad because it's obviously been an important part of the community, and particularly for the deaf community. I mean, at the minute, I believe Thangam Debonair, the Labour MP, has got her office in there. But I suppose that doesn't make enough, you know, whatever she's paying for her office space isn't enough to...
If it is in there, then it's nothing to do with the deaf people anymore, because they've had to sell it off to this company which is running a conference and office facility. Mm. So she's paying her money to the new people.
Well, I presume she'll have to if she wants to stay there and the building's changed hands. She'll have to pay whoever owns it, won't she?
Anyway, seems to be lots of problems in the news we've had over the last few weeks for disabled people generally. Next story, the street-level dealers have been locked up in a huge sweep. This is in Bristol 24/7 by Louis Emmanuel on 29th of January. More than 60 street-level drug dealers from across Bristol have been locked up for a total of 181 years in one of the largest police operations of its kind in the city. Sentences handed out at Bristol Crown Court on Friday marked the end of a massive sweep where undercover officers caught dealers on cameras before a series of dawn raids in November last year. The The general principle here is that it's a street level dealer. And if you go onto Bristol 24/7 website, Jane, you'll find there's loads and loads of comments on there where people are just saying, well, this is a complete waste of time because in a few seconds, you know, there's going to be another person who's going to take the job of those street dealers. I also noticed, looking at a list of the people who'd been convicted, something like half of them were no fixed abode, homeless people.
Yeah, well, I think that's... you know, that, for me, that's the main thing about the story, that, you know, you are solving one problem, but, you know, immediately all, you know, their replacements will spring up. And you've got to look at the reasons for why they're getting into this sort of crime in the first place. You know, surely it's because of lack of opportunities, you know, employment. Maybe, you know, there's lots of reasons for these things. And, you know, they're not being taken into account. They're just... plonking them in prison, which is actually a training ground for more criminal activity. You know, it's not something that's a solution. And it's like, yes, get them off the streets now. You know, obviously we don't want that, but you know, we need to have a bit more of a bigger picture approach to it.
Well, Martin,
not really
even
the answer.
Even Oliver Cosgrove, he's the temporary chief inspector who led the operation, he says certainly there's always a danger that when you send a lot of drug dealers to prison, there's a lot of people who are going to want to fill that void.
Well, that's what happened a few years ago when they slept up the front line in St Paul's, and then a new gang of lads took over, and then the other lads came out of prison and it turned into a shooting match. The real problem is that drugs shouldn't be illegal. And the real problem also is that the financial services sector is totally dependent on the illegal drugs market. There's a book, there's a report by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which came out in 2009, staffed by police officers from all over the world, and they said, you know what happened last year when the financial crisis happened? All the drug dealers on the planet rushed to the banks and said, do you want some money? And they all said, yes, please, thanks very much. And HSBC had been convicted in the courts in the United States of America of money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, which is actually aligned with the CIA.
And funding terrorism as
well.
Yeah,
and funding terrorism, well, of course, but that was just to do with money for the Iranians. But, I mean, the point is that the illegal drugs trade is essential to the financial services industry. The banks would have collapsed without it. The CIA have been involved in it for years. People will remember Colonel Oliver North, who used to be Reagan's fixer. He was definitely involved in bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the United States of America through the Mena Air Base in Arkansas, which was actually, Arkansas at that time was being run by Bill Clinton, so he got a kick off on it. And of course it was the Reagan administration that were running all of this, and they flooded the cities of the western east coast with crack cocaine in order to fund an illegal terrorist war in Nicaragua against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, who won two democratic elections, and an illegal terrorist war killed 30,000 civilians, mostly nursery workers and nurses and other people of that kind. And the CIA have been in it up to their eyeballs for years. So they began dealing drugs in the 1940s to try and make sure the nationalists won the civil war in China.
So are you saying you think these arrests maybe should have been made a little bit further up the chain?
The point is that this is absolutely irrelevant. But people will come back and it won't make any difference to the ability of people to buy drugs on the streets of Bristol. I absolutely guarantee you that. It made no difference whatsoever. We've got to actually have an adult conversation about this.
So why are the police doing this then? If it's not
because it's because on the statute book it says that these things are illegal activities and therefore they've got to go around and do something about it. And we've actually got to change our attitude towards. There's no Lord Green, who was the head of HSBC. When they were convicted in the courts in the US.
Chairman,
yeah. He was far from being prosecuted. He was actually appointed to the cabinet as Cameron's advisor on tax and tax avoidance. That was his punishment for HSBC being money laundering for the Sinaloa. And what they were doing in Mexico, they'd actually altered their banking facilities so that there were places where you could put full briefcases full of money straight through into the thing without having to take it out and count it first, and that actually completely changed all of the internal structure of the banks that they were running in Mexico, so that people just walk in and hand over a suitcase full of money. The financial services sector is totally dependent on the illegal drugs trade is bigger than the car industry.
Okay, so who are the real big guys then that the police, David and Somerset, well, police should have gone for?
Well, what about Lord Green for starters? I mean, basically, the whole of the financial services sector is deeply implicated in the drugs trade.
Well, aren't the...
I mean, they should all be arrested anyway,
Martin,
for other
things. Aren't the intelligence services doing something about this?
No, the intelligence services are deeply involved in it. I just mentioned the CIA's involvement in what was going on.
What about here in Britain? There's no evidence.
MI6 are closely allied with the CIA. The CIA are drug dealers. MI6 are also drug dealers. They are funding the war in Syria, partly through drugs being transmitted via Kosovo. Kosovo Liberation Army, very much a CIA MI6 front organisation. They are major heroin traffickers. The heroin industry in Afghanistan, which had been closed down by the Taliban, has been put back in business. They are now the biggest suppliers of heroin in the world. And Walid Karzai, who is the brother of Hamid Karzai, who was the imposed puppet president of Afghanistan, he was assassinated, and he was working with the CIA. He was on the CIA payroll, also the biggest drug dealer in Afghanistan. And of course, we actually defeated the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s by allowing them, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, helped by the SAS, the CIA, MI6, they funded themselves through putting people into selling heroin on the streets of Bristol, which was the money for that then went to Afghanistan to kill Russian conscript soldiers. That's the facts. That's the reality. And we've got to legalise drugs, not because drugs are good for you, but because the dirty money associated with drugs has completely corrupted whole countries like Colombia and Mexico. And everybody in those countries knows that certain cartels, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, for example, the Cali cartel in Colombia, are working with the CIA. And so what they then do is they then use the Drug Enforcement Administration and all the police and everything to take down the opposition to the politically favoured drug cartels who are working with the intelligence services. So when you say the intelligence services, aren't they doing something about this, it makes me laugh. Because in actual fact, all the evidence shows that they've been deeply implicated in this for years and years and years. The head of MI6 should probably be put on trial for drug dealing. He won't be, will he?
Interesting, Martin. Certainly fascinating insight, and contrasted to the 30 or so, it looks like, homeless people who've been jailed because of this raid. Fascinating. Let's go on to have a little listen back to Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions now, because apparently the Prime Minister's just come back from Europe with a fantastic deal.
John Mann.
Mr. Speaker, is that it? Is it the best the Prime Minister can do? Nothing for British pensioners, nothing for British workers, and as the Office for Budget Responsibility and the Treasury have both confirmed, his long-term economic plan is reliant on over 1 million new migrants entering this country before 2020. Has the Prime Minister got the bottle to confirm this inconvenient truth?
Well, I tell you what we're doing for pensioners, and that is a triple lock on pensions. Never again the 75p rise they got from Labour, but either prices or wages or 2.5%. I can tell you what we're doing for people who want to work hard in Britain, that is create 2.3 million more jobs since I became Prime Minister. But yes, of course, I believe that we'll succeed more as a country if we get a good deal in Europe and stay in a reformed Europe. That will be good for jobs, good for investment, good for growth. And that's what I'm fighting for.
Jane Westhead from Independence for Bristol, what do you make of that? Has he come back with a deal or not?
Not that I know of. And what is a triple lock on pensions? Sounds like some kind of strange lock that you might have on your door.
Martin?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that he went to Poland yesterday to talk to the new government in Poland, the Kaczynski. Kaczynski isn't the Prime Minister, but he might as well be. It's the Law and Justice Party. They're very right-wing, very conservative, very Catholic, and he might have thought he was going to get some change from them. But they are absolutely, as you can well imagine, any government of Poland would be, why is it that when our nationals come to Poland to sweep your streets, drive your buses, wipe your bottoms in the National Health Service, that they're not going to get in-work benefits like everybody else? And so, in actual fact, this deal that he's done, it's got to be ratified by all 27 other national governments. And actually, they're not interested in ratifying the deal. So we're going to go to a referendum very shortly, which will be fascinating. absolutely fascinating, because it may well be that Britain will vote to leave. But at the same time as we're doing that, Deutsche Bank will be collapsing because its derivatives exposure. Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland might vote differently from England, which means that we're then talking about having borders between us and them. And of course, it's all in the middle of the Eurozone could be crashing out. It's not because the Euro. I'm agnostic about this. The banking system is going to collapse very soon. I've got a background in economics. That's what people should be talking about. Deutsche Bank is actually collapsing as we speak. The stuff I read suggests that they're the most exposed of all the banks. And so we're arguing about, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And it won't make any difference, really. If we left Europe, we would still have to pay into the EU budget. People don't realise this. The Norwegians pay in as much as we do, because you have to do a deal with the Europeans, even if you're not in Europe. And so it's all airy-fairy stuff, frankly.
Okay, so one of the effects of all of this financial crisis, of course, has been on the National Health Service, and particularly on cancer, which is what the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, brought up with David Cameron this week.
Jeremy Corbyn! Mr. Speaker, it's very interesting the Prime Minister did not answer the question I put, which is whether or not he will proceed with the cut in ESA to 3,200 people with cancer at the present time. I hope he thinks seriously about this and does not proceed with this proposal. He will find that Macmillan Cancer Support, Rethink Mental Health Illness, Parkinson's UK are all united in opposing this cut because of the effect it will have on people with a range of very serious conditions. The Prime Minister used to say that those with the broadest shoulders should bear a greater load. Can it be right that cancer patients and those with disabilities on £102 per week really are those with the broadest shoulders who should bear this cut? Please, Prime Minister, think again and don't try and reverse the decision of the House of Lords on this important matter.
Yeah. The people with the broadest shoulders are the highest earners in this country, and they're paying a higher share of tax than they ever did under Labour. And that money is paying for our NHS, is paying for our welfare system. And I answer the question very directly. If you're an existing claimant on employment and support allowance, your welfare isn't changing. But in future, those people who are able to get back to work, we should help them to get back to work. That is what a compassionate country does. But it's quite clear what Labour's policy is. Cut the NHS in Wales, put up taxes in Scotland to pay for more welfare. That's not the approach that this country needs.
Martin, are people on cancer having their benefits cut as well now?
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn was actually giving the Prime Minister a get out there, saying, look, you're not actually going to save that much money by taking the money off these people. And actually, when these people die, having had their money cut, maybe that's going to be all over the newspapers, and the government are going to look silly. So he's actually given him a get out there, but he doesn't want to take it. And when he talks about the people with the broadest shoulders who are paying more in tax, those will be the people we were talking about who were involved in the drugs industry earlier, the people who run the banks, the people on bonuses, because the financial services industry in Britain and all over the world has been bailed out by the taxpayer to the tune of billions. And that's why there's no money in the kitty. And that's why people on cancer have to have their money cut, so that the City of London can carry on doing what the City of London does, which is ripping us off.
Before we hear from you, Jane, let's go to another question, which is actually about PFI, because obviously many hospitals are having to pay vast amounts of money now in interest. So let's hear that question now. I think it's from Stella Creasy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has told us today that more money is going into the NHS. Let me tell him that my local hospital trust is spending £1.5 million a week on interest payments alone to Innisfree for its PFI deal. Now, wait for it. Come on. The Prime Minister eventually saw sense about the need to deal with the damage that high-cost credit was doing to individuals. When will he deal with these legal loan sharks of the public sector?
Sometimes it takes a long time to unwind the damage done by a Labour government. She's absolutely right. PFI, one of the first things we did in government was to launch a review of Labour's PFI and begin an initiative to extract savings and give better value for money for all of the projects, including Bart's. What we're seeing in her own health economy is we're seeing there are more GPs in the NHS, and in terms of the NHS Waltham Forest Clinical Commissioning Group, next year they're getting a cash increase of 3.7%. That is money provided because we're putting more money into the NHS.
Jane, what do you make of that? Two questions, really. One is about PFI, and the other one, I suppose, is about taking benefits away from cancer patients.
Oh, right. OK, they're taking the benefits away from...
the first clip, and the second one, it's up to you, really, what you make of it.
I'm just talking about that one. I thought it was David Cameron answered that well, unwinding the damage done by a Labour government, pointing out that PFI was actually brought in by Labour. But I do see, these PFI deals are... a lot of companies will see the NHS as a cash cow, but, they can charge whatever they want for, things like a sink cost £3,000 to put in. That was one of the things that I heard lately. And, obviously if it was just in your own house, it would only cost, a few hundred. So... Going back to the topic of the cancer patients, the employment and support allowance, I don't know a lot about that, but I agree with Martin about the broad shoulders of the people that are paying a lot of tax should
pay more.
Pay more, yes.
They should be in prison and their assets should be confiscated.
Martin, say that again, sorry.
A lot of these people should be in prison and their assets should be confiscated. And that's the way we'd close.
Well, one of the problems here is that MPs don't necessarily understand much about money. And I spoke earlier this week on the Dialect programme, the podcast only, I'm afraid. We're hoping to have Dialect back on BCFM soon. I spoke to Mark Kerridge. The website is www.dialectradio.co.uk, because they did a survey of MPs to find out if they understood money.
We managed to get a debate in Parliament last year on money creation. First time in 144 years that had happened.
Wow.
So, but then on just before that debate, Positive Money, we got Dodds, who are a polling organisation, to poll MPs and ask them a number of questions, multiple choice, about how money is created. 10% had any idea of how banking works and how money is created.
So it almost seems like a dark art they don't want you to know about.
It's something that hasn't been talked about for an awful long time. The banks have huge power. It's the biggest business in the world, if you like. This power to basically create money out of thin air and rent it to society as a whole.
That's from Mark Kerridge from Positive Money here in Bristol, a little group that meets from time to time. You can find links to them at dialectradio.co.uk, but really underlining MPs do not understand the money system, how it really works. Let's have a final story this week, very briefly, from both of you. Boy with narcolepsy wins £120,000 swine flu vaccine damages. I bet his parents wish they hadn't vaccinated him for swine flu. Jane?
Well, I haven't got that far yet.
I'll tell you briefly the story. He had an injection, a vaccine against swine flu, and then now he's got narcolepsy, which means he keeps falling asleep all the time, and he's just been awarded £120,000 compensation. The government is appealing, saying actually we don't really want to pay him this money. Martin?
Well, I think the problem with all medical interventions for profit is that there's always a tendency to push things which shouldn't be pushed. That's the whole point of having a National Health Service. Decisions should be clinical, and that's all.
Okay.
They aren't.
Time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. We'll be back after the news, talking John Cabot and the discovery, as if the Native Americans hadn't already done
this
it, of America.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.